Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hey, this is Mark Pattison back again with another awesome episode of Finding Your Summit. I am so pumped. I'm sitting here in Sun Valley, Idaho, one of my favorite spots in the entire planet. And I interviewed Ed Viesters. And Ed is a guy who I've climbed with years ago, but he's the only American to have climbed all 14 8-meter peaks. That's peaks that are over 26,000 feet. And get this. He did so without any oxygen. Can you imagine that? Everybody that climbs to Everest has tanks on their back. They've got the big face mask. That's certainly what I will have when I climb up that mountain. But he's done it. He just his own will, power, and strength that gets him up and down these mountains. Obviously, he's got a very strong lung capacity. But I just had such a blast talking with Ed. We go back, we talk about his earlier days cutting his teeth with great mentors like Lou Whitaker on Mount Rainier, really teaching him the ropes on how to climb safely. And then we get into when he was filming the IMAX piece, which unfortunately coincided with the same time that the whole Into Thin Air, the Everest tragedy happened in 1996. It actually turned into a rescue mission for him. He tried to go up and get Rob Hall and Scott Fisher, two of his buddies, who ultimately did not make it. And it's a very emotional moment of talking about when that actually happened. And then they did decide to press on a couple of weeks later to finish the IMAX piece. And those guys are still sitting up there. So to actually pass your buddies and have that moment, it's pretty emotional. So we talk about it. We talked about his choices, about no shortcuts to the top, about why he's still standing and where he's at today. So Ed is a phenomenal guy and full of inspiration, and he really has life in the right frame mindset of how to go about it. And he shares that with many corporations throughout America. So we'll get to Ed in just a second. But as always, if anybody wants to find out about my journey, it's at markpattisonnfl.com. That's where you can find the podcast and other climbs that I'm doing. And as always, please go out there and rate and review on iTunes. It really does help. And if anybody out there has any questions, comments, please reach out to me. Send me an email. You can find that on my website. And I will always answer. And if you have any recommendations on people who'd make phenomenal guests, I'd love to hear. Okay? So on that note, let's talk to Ed. Here we go. Hey, this is Mark Pattison back again with another awesome episode of Finding Your Summit. And this week brings me to Sun Valley, Idaho. And I'm so stoked to have a guy that I've admired for a long time. And his name is Ed Viesters. Ed, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
I want to start off with a story about you and I, Jim Mora, and Todd Lewicki, who at the time was the CEO and president of the Seattle Seahawks. And this might have been about 8 years ago. And there was a charity climb that you guys were doing, but prior to that charity climb, we were going to go to Mount Rainier and climb up to Calmir, which is about a 5,000-foot gain, right, from Paradise up to Mir.
Right, yep.
And we just had a fantastic time. We picked you up about 20 miles outside of an actual parking lot in Paradise called Longmire. And it was interesting because you wanted to hear about NFL stories, and all we wanted to hear about climbing stories. And so we were kind of grilling you at the time.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. And Jim and I, we like to climb. We've climbed a lot together. And so we were really excited that we were in this
in your presence. And so I want to give you a lot of credit for where I'm at today in a story that you don't know, which is we all set off together at 5,000 feet, and we were more or less all hanging until about 8,000. And then at that point, we're in the pretty steep snowfields, and you and I just took off.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept up with you, and you've always been known for this amazing lung capacity, which we'll get into here in a few minutes. But I felt like I was keeping more or less stride to stride. We were chit-chatting. I wasn't breathing hard. And it was at that point, one of the points, where I started to have this idea about climbing these crazy mountains all over the world. And not that I can hang and do the type of things that you do, but it just gave me kind of a sense of confidence that this might be something that I could do.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, I'm glad I was part of that inspiration.
Well, we all take inspiration from different people. Mm-hmm. And a guy who I interviewed last week was Steve Largent. And you probably know Steve,
yep.
You know, all pro, Hall of Fame. And when, as we're going through it, I was a freshman in high school when he was a rookie on the Seattle Seahawks team. So I literally grew up with him as my role model. And I think that's all part of the success strategies in so many people is finding others that have come before them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you've had guys like that in your path.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the big things I learned when I started guiding on Rainier was I knew there were guides there that had 10, 15 more years experience than me. And I had two or three of them that I chose as my mentors, the people that I looked up to, the people that I wanted to emulate because of their attitude and the way they thought about climbing and how they treated their clients. And I didn't say, hey, you're my mentor, but I silently followed them and watched them and listened to them. And I thank them now for my success and the reasons that I'm still alive. Being in the mountains, there's a lot of risk, and it's all about how you make decisions. And I learned a lot from those mentors of mine, how to be in the mountains and do it safely.
There's a guy that may have been one of those mentors that he was one of my original podcast guys that came on, Lou Whitaker.
Yeah, Lou was, in my world on Mount Rainier, he was like the top dog. And on Mount Rainier with the guides, it's very much an apprenticeship. And you learn from the guy that's above you, that's learned from the guy that's above him. And so it's this trickle-down effect of leadership and teaching and experience. And then if you show that you're a good team player and that you can perform, and this is what happened to me. I started to get invited by my teachers and my mentors to go on expeditions with them, Lou Whitaker being one of those. He took me along to Kanchenjunga, the third highest peak in the world, and that became my first 8,000-meter summit. So if it wasn't for people like that that saw, you know, the ability that I had, and they said, hey, we're going to bring you along. We want you to be part of this team. And by doing that, I gained experience as well under their leadership.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so for people who don't know, Ed Biesters is the only American to have climbed all 14 8-meter peaks, and it took you 21 times to do those 14, is that right?
Yeah, they're called the 8,000-meter peaks,
okay.
And that's any mountain that's over 26,000 feet. And it took me, all told, 18 years to do that, and to climb 14 successfully, I made 21 attempts. So you have to learn that in the mountains, you don't always achieve your goal. There's a lot of things that prevent you from success. Weather, avalanches. We have a saying that the mountain decides. You have to listen to the mountain. And that's what keeps you alive. I mean, if you're stubborn and arrogant and have this attitude of, I need to summit at all costs, a lot of times you won't come home. It has to be a round trip. So there's a lot of times when you have to temper your ambition. You're motivated, you've trained, you've been working your way up the mountain for sometimes 3 months. And if conditions aren't good, you've got to learn to just turn around and walk away. And I've turned around 300 feet from the summit of Everest.
That's incredible. So we talked about this shortly before we went live here, and the name of this podcast is called Finding Your Summit. So what you're talking about, and I talk about this in my own speeches now to people about adversity. And this last May, I was on Denali, and it was minus 60 at the top. And at that 14,000-foot camp, mm-hmm. I can't remember if that's camp 3 or 4, but, you know, we hung out there for a week, mm-hmm. and it's minus 25 just there. And we knew that if we went on top, and there's this lenticular cloud just sitting like the Wicked Witch of the West
oh, yeah.
up there, and we knew that if we went up, You're talking about risking life and laying fingers and toes. And so we weren't willing to do that. And in a sense, there was an adversity around that because every guy is carrying 126 pounds just to get in that position
right
before you go up that steep wall, right, to get to the top. And we couldn't do that. And for you, this has happened many times.
Mm-hmm.
You had to make that hard decision. Was this something that was taught to you from Lou Whitaker and the guys at RMI, or is this something from your childhood that just about safety first and you want to take risk but measured risk?
I think for me, it was a personal thought, and it was also taught to me as a guide. When we're guiding, the number one rule is we have to keep our customers alive. So that helps you to make decisions in the mountains. So I learned that way. I always felt as well, if I'm out there climbing on my own, I'm doing it for myself. I don't really care what people think about what I'm doing or where I'm going. It has to be a personal goal, but I don't want to kill myself doing it. I always say I like climbing mountains, but I like being alive a little bit more. And so that was always my attitude. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to do my very best. If conditions allow and I'm prepared and I've done my homework, then I get to succeed. But if conditions don't allow me to do something safely, I wasn't willing to lose a finger or toe to frostbite, let alone die. I just couldn't get my head around that idea. That's a huge price to pay. It's not worth it. So I'd always been willing to temper my ambition. And when I came home, let's say, turning 300 feet from the summit of Everest because of bad conditions, I would come home and say, you know what? I didn't fail. Failure is when you don't plan, when you don't prepare, when you don't try. But if you've done your very best and you're prevented from success, it's not your fault. And I just call it a non-success. So I turn it into something more positive. And then I just say, you know what? I get to go back to Everest. I get to try again. I don't have to. I get to.
Yeah.
If an NFL team doesn't win the Super Bowl this year, they don't quit. They come back next year and they go, we're going to regroup or I'm going to try again. We get to try again. Same idea.
No, I totally appreciate that and certainly relate to it. I mean, certainly mm-hmm. that happened to us in the NFL, the teams I played on. But also the mountain. I got to admit, I had to kind of like rearrange my head a little bit because I was so frustrated. I knew we couldn't get up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't willing to go that extra distance to have something catastrophic occur within the team. But at the same time, I was like, God, now I got to come back and do it all over again. But now I'm all jacked up because I'm training hard.
Right.
Got my eye on the ball again. And that whole momentum is starting to kick in again.
Yeah. I mean, you're just as excited, if not more, right?
Yeah.
Because you've tasted it. You know what it's going to take. And you're like, bring it. I get to go try again. And sometimes it took me 3 expeditions to climb Everest. I went once, came back. Went again, came back. And on the 3rd trip, everything fell into place. And then I was ready for it. Same idea. And if you enjoy the process of getting ready, which it sounds like you do, and then you enjoy the actual journey of the climb itself, if you get to the summit, that's great. But if you can't, then it's the experience that matters, right?
Yeah, I can tell you from my own experience. I mean, you've been on way more than I have, but just the whole preparation, going to different countries, experiencing these different cultures has been just an absolute joy in my life to go do. And, you know, they call it adventure travel, maybe.
Right.
But it's really, rather than go sit at the Grand Wailea in Hawaii for a week, which I've done a lot of, it's just, I don't know, it's just so much more thrilling for me to reach goals that you didn't think were possible.
Right, right. It is expanding yourself and you meet people, you push your limits, and you discover, I think, something about yourself every time you go. How hard can you push? How uncomfortable are you willing to be for success? And you go, I never thought I could do that. And then you do it. And sometimes we look at these goals, they seem impossible or overwhelming. And I've always said, you know what? Don't look too far ahead. Have that goal, but break it down. I'm going to do what I need to do today. And today I might have to break that into steps. And in the mountains, you break it down into breaths. And that's how you achieve these little goals every single day. And the next thing you know, you're on the top.
Have you come back from one of these expeditions and kicked yourself? I'm sure it hasn't happened much, but you kicked yourself because you didn't do what you always said you were going to do in terms of you should have turned back. Maybe ultimately you did, but you took it just maybe one step further that you shouldn't have.
I did. And that was on the mountain we call K2.
Ugh.
It's the mountain in Pakistan.
I'm scared of that mountain.
Yeah.
I'll never do that. I mean, that's just scared of much, but I'm fearful of that mountain.
Yeah, it is. We think it's the hardest 8,000 meter peak to climb. It's not quite as high as Everest. It's only 700 feet lower, but the technical terrain is way bigger than Everest. It's unpredictable weather, and it's such this alluring mountain that people are often willing to risk more for K2 even than Everest. And it's not for people that with the experience level of Everest. You've got to have a whole nother level of experience to climb K2.
This is like rock climbing?
Well, it's just steeper, technical. There's no relatively easy way. You have to have a lot of experience and willpower and patience. And when I went there in 92, nobody had climbed it for 7 years, although 35 teams had tried. I mean, that's how relentlessly challenging this mountain is.
Yeah.
So we went and we did battle with K2, and 2.5 months later at high camp with my buddy Scott Fisher, and a storm came in. We were thinking of going to the summit the next day, and we were trapped or stuck. We stayed in that tent for 3 days waiting, thinking, you know, if there's a break in the weather, we need to be here to take advantage of it. And finally, we got a break in the weather and we started going toward the summit, and the weather started to deteriorate, started to snow. And I thought, we still have 6, 7, 8 hours to go to the summit. And with all this new snow accumulating on the descent, the conditions are going to be horrendously dangerous. I should turn around now before it's too late. And I always had this idea of I need to think ahead, plan ahead rather than just think in the moment. Whereas I was with Scott and another climber, and they were more, I think, in the moment and weren't as worried about what was going to happen later. And I convinced myself that I was making a big mistake. I should have just unroped from them and gone down. And that's the point where people have their own level of acceptable risk. And if you're with 2 other 3 people and they want to keep going and you don't, it's okay to let them go their way and you go your way. So I knew I was making that mistake, and I said I should just go down. I never quite made the decision to unrope and go down.
Yeah.
I'm on the summit and coming down.
Is that the first time you've been on summit?
Yeah, the first and only time. Yeah. I mean, K2 is one of those mountains where if you climb it and walk away,
put it in the bag,
you don't ever go back. Yeah. And we made it down, but I think by the skin of our teeth through avalanche conditions. And when I got back to high camp, I was angry with what I'd done that day. For me, that was not the way I had lived my life as a mountaineer. And I broke all my rules. You know, it wasn't as I was ignorant or arrogant. I just wasn't willing to make the right decision. And I told myself, never again do that. Never again. If I ever felt something was wrong, instinctively listen to it and walk away. 40 people are going one way and you don't want to, you go the other way. Live by your own rules.
Did you feel like you've been sucked in by Scott and the guys on the team of like, come on, we got it?
No, I didn't feel that pressure. It was my own lack of willingness to stop myself. Mm-hmm. They weren't pressuring me. I wasn't feeling bad about it. I just didn't make the decision on my own. And then obviously I thought, am I overthinking this? Am I being too conservative? But that's okay. So that was a big lesson for me, not to do that again. And I never did it again.
Yeah, well, look, I have no desire to go to K2. That's one that I will live through you on that. And a lot of it, too, is just, it's kind of like you don't go from Little League to the NFL. You got to have your ducks in a row. You have to know what you're doing or you can get hurt in a very bad way. Not to mention you're just completely in over your head.
Yeah.
Which that would be, I'm learning as I go, but I'm not there. And I don't have the skills that would safely get me up and down a mountain like K2.
Right. I mean, I think you're smart enough to know when you're ready to go to the next level. I mean, a lot of people want to shortcut it and they go, hey, I've climbed Mount Rainier. Now I want to go to Mount Everest. Yeah. That's way too fast. And they think with the right people around them and the right guides and the right support staff, they can be nurtured to the summit. And in some cases you can, but I'd rather have the experience to know when I'm making a mistake and how to take care of myself. And so I was very careful about taking my time, slowly climbing higher mountains, slowly gaining more experience. And then I knew when I was ready to go to the next level. And by the time I went to K2, I'd gone on 3 or 4 Everest expeditions. I'd climbed Kanchenjunga. I felt ready to try K2. And that's what I told people. I'm going to go try K2. I'm not going to climb it, but I will do my best to try to climb it. So with that attitude, I think you open yourself out to more possibilities. And if it doesn't work out, you're okay with it. You go back and try again. But you've learned from what you just did.
How many people have actually climbed K2?
Not that many. I mean,
it's a short list, right?
Yeah. I mean, to date, there's, I think, 5,000 people that have climbed Everest and maybe 200. And when we climbed K2, I think we were 60 or 70th, something like that. So it's a smaller group of people that go to K2 and an even smaller group that succeed on K2.
And were you wearing oxygen?
Nope. I did all of my ascents by my own personal rule without oxygen.
So I've looked at you, and I'm trying to figure out somewhere, because I've got a fairly high lung capacity. I don't know where I fall on the measuring stick.
Mm-hmm.
All that, for me, has to do with, as a wide receiver, of all the conditioning, and I would just go and go and go
mm-hmm.
until when other people are falling down, I just still managed through breathing and things like that to just not be fatigued. And I don't mean this comparison in the wrong way, because I have respect for this other individual despite what he did to get there. But I think it was all relative to his sport, which is Lance Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
Lance, I think, also has very high lung capacity
right.
to push himself to levels that most people can't go mm-hmm. without tremendous fatigue. And for you to climb all these different mountains with no oxygen is insane, incredible, amazing. And what do you think it is with your chemistry that allows you to do that?
Well, there's a few ingredients, I think. The first was that I made the commitment to saying, I will only attempt to climb these mountains without supplemental oxygen. And if you kind of leave yourself open to say, well, I'm going to try, and if it gets too hard, then maybe I'll use oxygen, that's an easy out. And I said, there's no way. If I can't climb Everest, if I can't climb K2 without oxygen, I will never climb these mountains. So I kind of set myself up for that mentally. And then physically, I knew I had to train myself very hard. Endurance and strength and running and lifting and biking, so that my body was capable of doing that. And then the third part is the lucky part, which is the genetics, which I didn't know I had. And I was tested a few years into my career. They said, hey, let's see, how are you able to do this? And I do have a high lung volume. I have a high VO2 max. I have a high anaerobic threshold, meaning that I can keep plowing along when other people are already going anaerobic. I'm still aerobic. And that was just by luck. I picked the right sport. And one out of a million people pick the right sport, and they're a little bit better than the rest. Why? But it's not just one thing. It's several things. And you know this as well. You trained physically, but you also had the physiological gift that let you perform longer and better than others, right? And that just kind of happens.
Yeah, no, I was reading somewhere about you that you did some, I think it was you and Brashears did some kind of a stress test, mental, on Everest to
yeah.
test altitude, how you perform and function. And I wanted to ask you, like, what kind of tests these things were?
Well, they were basically mental acuity tests. Memorization, we'd have to read something, memorize it, then repeat it. And it was more of trying to see how you do mentally at each different elevation gain on Everest. And to me, you could kind of predict that you're going to do worse and worse and worse the higher you go, simply because of the lack of oxygen.
Sure.
We had people on the climb that were using oxygen as well. And the big part for me with test taking is, even at sea level, if you're well rested and you take a test versus being exhausted and you take the test, you're going to do worse when you're exhausted. Even people that climb Everest with oxygen, that have all those benefits of stronger, faster, warmer by using oxygen, if you're exhausted on the summit, you're going to do worse taking a test than somebody that's highly trained that just climbed without oxygen. It was just kind of a contrived, in my view, scientific thing that we were just kind of showing, we know what's going to happen, and here's the proof.
It's still interesting, though.
It was interesting, yeah. It was interesting, and it was fun. We did it for Nova, and it was a cool trip to go to Everest again with Brashears, who I'd been with the year before. So it was a fun scientific documentary we made.
Yeah, so you guys did one of the highest grossing films of all time, the IMAX film
mm-hmm.
of Everest.
Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but this is where the whole in the thin air tragedy kind of took place. At the time, obviously, nobody knew what was going on, but your buddy Scott Fisher, Rob Hall, they were leading different expeditions up the mountain. You guys had your own thing going on, carrying these gigantic cameras,
mm-hmm.
going to the top. And so how did you become involved in that whole rescue? I mean, how did that all play out?
When you go to Everest, especially base camp, it becomes this community, this village of climbers. And I believe 96, there might have been 15 teams there. Two of the larger teams were the commercial expeditions run by Scott Fisher and Rob Hall, who were friends of mine. So we could see each other operating. You're going down, they're going up, and you kind of share information. And toward the end of the expedition, when everybody's trying to pick their summit dates, Rob and Scott and the Taiwanese expedition decided to go to the summit together on May 10th, which you feel safety in numbers, right? I'd rather go with a bunch of people. But high on Everest, I'd rather be with a smaller team. You're faster, you can more control. And we heard about this, and we as a team decided, well, why don't we go a day before? Let's go on May 9th. So we were actually a day ahead of these guys. As they're going up, we're going up. But on the morning of May 8th, David and I looked out the tent door and we thought the weather wasn't yet perfect enough. That window of climbing weather for the summit, we felt, had not yet arrived.
Did you have the technology at that time to forecast bad weather coming in like they do now?
It wasn't as good. It was even more archaic. And a lot of times in the mountains, you use that as an information tool, but basically just got to stick your nose out the door and look at your barometer and what's the wind doing and make a guess. And we just felt that the traditional calm, perfect weather had not yet arrived. It was still kind of funky. And it was more, if anything, instinctive as well. And David and I said, let's go down. Let's wait for something better. It doesn't have to happen today. So we weren't giving up. We were just kind of pulling back and waiting. And as we went down, we passed our friends. They were going on their way up. And they looked at us and we looked at them and they're like, why are you guys going down? And we couldn't really explain why. And we obviously couldn't tell them not to go up. And
it goes back to that instinct that you had, right?
Yeah. So we were like, wow, are we making the right decision? These guys are going up. Three teams are still going up and we're going down. And you're like, then you start to doubt yourself. Once you make your team decision, you just got to stick with it, right? Don't get pulled along. And little did we know what was going to happen. They started at the right time on May 10th. They started early enough. But a few things happened. It wasn't one major decision that day. It was a whole bunch of little things. They climbed too slowly. They had bottlenecks. They missed their turnaround time. And when the turnaround time on Everest, especially when you use oxygen, means you've gone beyond the amount of oxygen that you have to climb up. And if you climb longer than that, you're going to start using the oxygen supply that you need for the way down. And it's not just going to show up somewhere. You have a limited supply. So they climbed beyond that. I think people were getting more and more exhausted. And on a good day, they probably could have gotten away with it, but they got caught high in the mountain. The storm blew in and you're already over that edge a little bit. And then that storm pushed them way over the edge. And five people died on that side of the mountain, trapped high in the mountain. Two of them were my friends, Rob Hall, Scott Fisher. We saw this, heard all this developing. We were down below. We were on the radio. And then we just said, you know what, we need to go up and help people down. We quit filming. Our expedition didn't matter at that point. You got to save people's lives. And the sad reality is at that high of an altitude, you physically have to climb to people to bring them down. Can't fly a helicopter that high. There's no other means of rescue. And if you can't reach people fast enough, they die of exposure and hypoxia.
So how many guys did you actually help down?
We had supplies of oxygen at Camp 4, which we gave away. We said, go into our tent, use what you need. So I don't know how many people that helped, but David and I physically helped Beck Weathers down off the mountain.
He's the physician, lost his fingers, his nose.
Yeah. And by the time we got to him, he was snowblind, his hands were frozen, and we then helped him down the Lhotse face. I remember it was a fixed rope, and I had one arm wrapped around the fixed rope. The other hand I was holding on to Beck's harness from behind because he couldn't hold the rope. And then David in front would actually help Beck place his feet into the slope because Beck couldn't see where his feet were. And over the next 2 days, we then helped Beck down off the mountain.
How steep is that?
It's up to 45 degrees. It's steep. It's icy. And even being able to see and hold onto the rope, it's a challenge, let alone being blind.
Incredible. Well, actually, a guy, he was not on that rope team, but we talked to him, Dick Bass. I was fortunate to meet him at Snowbird many years ago. It was at a charity thing, Steve Young. And he came and sat down at our table and he was talking to us. And, you know, actually tears are coming down his face talking about that tragedy.
Yeah.
You know, he'd been up and down. He was the first guy to kind of pave this whole Seven Summit thing. And just read the book and just incredible. A combination of a lot of things. Some probably could have been avoided. Some that couldn't. And one of the things I've always wondered, I mean, Rob Hall and Scott Fisher were your friends, right? And do you think there was any way that he could have made it down? Because I know there's, I can't remember which one, but they're sitting up top talking to his wife that passed him through, and she's trying to get him to go down, and he's just not moving.
Well, what happened was I spoke to Rob at length on the radio as well. When after he and his client Doug Hansen, finally, they couldn't move anymore. It was way too late at night. The storm was raging. And Doug, I think, simply just couldn't move anymore. And we didn't know through the night what was happening. And we're all on the radio. And then the next morning, it was very early, 4:30 or 5, Rob crackles onto the radio and he said, "I'm stuck up here. When is somebody coming up to help me?" And we're like, yeah, we have people trying to work their way up to him. The storm continued. And he was at a place where after you descend from the summit of Everest, you then are in a saddle and you need to go up over what's called the South Summit. Okay. So he was at the base of that, meaning that if he was trying to help himself, he would have to climb up and over the South Summit even before it could start going down. And we then asked him, "Where's Doug?" And the only thing he said was, "Doug's gone." So the mystery is, did Doug fall? Is Doug dead? Doug's gone. That could mean a lot of different things. And I kept trying to tell Rob, I knew him very well, and I said, "Listen, some guys are working their way up to get you, or try, but can you please help them by helping yourself? Can you try to get yourself up and over the South Summit?" And I did everything I could to cheerlead him, to yell at him. I told him some jokes. I got him to laugh. And then we said, "Rob, just start working your way up and don't talk. Save your radio batteries." And a few hours later, I checked in. I said, "How's it going, Rob?" And he said, "I haven't moved. I can't. My hands are frozen. My feet are frozen. I'm fucked," basically is what he said. At that point, we kind of knew that he could not help himself. And then David and I started climbing up to help others. And at some point during that day, we heard that the Sherpa that were trying to go up to get Rob had to turn around as well because of the storm that had continued. And I remember David stopped and looked around and said, "Ed, I think it's time to say goodbye to Rob. Nobody can get to him." And it was that night where we patched him through to his wife. They had a phone call together. That night he went to sleep and we knew he wouldn't wake up. And I imagine he knew that as well. Imagine sitting there going, "I'm going to close my eyes and I'm not going to survive this." That's a huge moment. And we were all there watching and listening and living through it. It was huge. It was a big deal.
So that's crazy. And I'm sure emotional for all you guys. Yeah. Your personal friends that all the stuff is going through. Time passes, and you guys stay on the mountain. And did you finish the film later? I mean, there was nothing you could do at that point. You know, ultimately, people came down. They were flown off. Their fate was what their fate was.
After all that, we helped bring Beck Weathers down. We evacuated the mountain. I mean, we cleared it. And we said, we need to just regroup. This has been this gigantic event. We had a memorial service at base camp. Everybody at base camp, we gathered, people spoke, we talked about what happened. And at that point, most teams were like, "Okay, we're going home. We're saddened. This is scary. This mountain can kill us." I mean, it was a reality check for a lot of people. And I remember David and I and our team, my wife was there. She was our base camp manager. We had a long discussion about what were we going to do. And I had already kind of decided what I wanted to do. I wanted to go back up. I wanted to finish what we set out to do. And if anything, turn it into something more positive. Instead of just running away, scared to death, I said, "Hey, we as a team haven't made any bad decisions. We've made good choices. We're still good. We have the strength. We have the time. Let's regroup. Let's at least go back up and try to finish this." Because knowingly, even David and I said, if we don't finish this film this year, we have to come back next year and get that camera all the way back up to where it is. And so we said, let's just try to finish it. And we went back up 2 weeks later, phenomenal weather, perfect conditions. I was again climbing without oxygen. I was so acclimatized, was like the perfect summit day.
You've been up there for months now.
Yeah, we've been there almost 3 months.
So what was that? I mean, this is another tough question, but now it is the perfect conditions. You guys summit, but mm-hmm. as you're going up there, you're passing your buddy.
Yeah.
Did you see both of them?
I saw both of them, yeah. Which was huge. I mean, I'd never lost a friend before, let alone walk past their bodies. Yeah. And I left high camp alone that morning because I was climbing without oxygen. We calculated that I would be climbing slower than the rest of my team. So I needed a head start. But in fact, nobody ever caught up to me that day. I was like, I'm going to the top, come hell or high water. But a few hours into the climb, I was still with my headlamp on. It was 3 a.m. or something. I see a body and it's Scott laying in the snow. And I wanted to spend some time with him, but I said, you know what? I'm going to focus all my energy on going to the summit. And on my way down, I'm going to sit with Scott and say goodbye. Further up toward the summit, I saw Rob. Same thing. I made it to the top. Safe sound. The team got to the top. The camera got to the top. I mean, everything we set out to do, we did in spite of all the difficulties. So I felt hugely proud about that. But then it was sad going down and just sitting with my friends. And we had to just leave them there. You can't bring them down.
Unfortunately, it's some of the realities of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And I also say to other people who get fearful about mountain climbing, I say it's a very measured risk.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Number two is that I think it falls into the people who tragically die. It's either through bad luck
mm-hmm.
or they're just completely in over their head, right? And I see more of that happening where if you happen to be in Nepal and once every 100 years there's an earthquake and
right.
you happen to be in the Kuma Field, when you happen to fall in, that's just bad luck.
Right.
You know? But I have been on every single climb I've been on, we have been with somebody or somebodies who are just in way over the head. They didn't prepare. They don't understand about the weight. They see the movie like you guys did.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, oh, yeah, I can do this. I want to be that guy. And they're not that guy.
Right.
Or that girl.
Right.
And they have to get flown off. I mean, Aconcagua is nowhere on the planet close to what Everest, some of these other mountains you've done. And we flew, out of the 12, we flew 6 people off the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like, what? And I could have told you that from day one, like climbing up, like, this person is not going to make it.
Right, right. And that's part of the hard part about guiding as well. You have a group of people that show up. You may know them from previous climbs, or they may have just signed up with a resume, which could be true, which could be not true. And then you get to the base of the mountain and you've got to create a team. Right? Out of a group of individuals. And each of these individuals have spent a fair amount of money. They have very high expectations. And all that pressure is then on the guide, right? This financial investment, the expectation of success. And, you know, you start with a group of 6 or 12 people. You're like, I've got to do my very best to get all these people to the top. But things start to happen. Some people aren't as prepared. Some people don't acclimatize. Some people don't listen to your teachings, you know, how can you be more efficient? And things start to fall apart very quickly in the mountains. And it's this whole can of worms that you've got to deal with as a guide. I see that in 96 on Everest. The financial investment on the client's part is huge. You know, they're each paying $50,000. So you add that, multiply that by 6, and you look at a guide like Rob or Scott, and they go, wow. Does that trickle into how they make their decisions? And I think it probably does.
Yeah.
Whereas I've always felt I've got to blind myself from that investment. Whether I'm guiding somebody on Rainier or Mount Everest, my rules have to be the same. Doesn't matter how much somebody's paid me. My job is to make smart decisions and keep them alive. But I think you can see how that trickles into how decisions get to be made.
Yeah, it's a marketing thing too, right? On the website, hey, 80% of our guys make the summit, whatever it is.
Yeah. I'd worked with Rob in 94. We guided together. I worked for him on Everest. We had 6 customers. We got all 6 to the summit. 100% success. And Rob used that in his marketing. Come with me. So you get people to sign up with you. We go again in 1995. I'm with Rob again. We had 6 clients. We turned around 300 feet from the summit. 0% success. So here comes 1996. Rob needed success.
Yeah.
He really, really did. And there's Scott, who is now his first trip to Everest with clients. to elevate his business to the next level. If he had success, wow. So he had that pressure. So your mountaineering rules start to get infringed upon by business. And that's kind of what happens.
So how long does that take when you're at 300 feet? Did you say 300 feet or 300 yards?
300 feet.
And how long in terms of Everest distance? I know what that is on a football field, but you know, how long does that take?
It's a couple of hours.
That is?
Yeah. To gain that altitude and then to get back to where you are, that's 3 hours. So if you're with a group of clients and some of them are already starting to falter, the weather's starting to change, you have to think about, okay, from here to the summit and back is 3 hours. How much is that going to consume into the energy of my clients, into the oxygen, into the good weather, right? All that stuff you have to calculate. You can't just wait until it's too late. You can't just say, oh, we can maybe get to the summit and then we'll figure it out on the way down.
Yeah.
It's too late. I mean, most accidents occur on Everest on the way down and you wonder why. Because by then people have used more of their energy than they have, more of their oxygen than they should have used, more of the daylight, all those things. You're fried and you're barely hanging in there. And then you throw a storm into the mix and then the house of cards falls apart.
Yeah.
That's what I call it, this house of cards that you're slowly building. And if it gets too tall and too teetery, it just takes one little thing to push it over and it collapses.
Yeah. No, that's a great metaphor. So on to the happier things with the movie. So it does go on to become one of the biggest movies of all time in terms of an IMAX film.
Correct. Yeah, right.
And did you guys go on the world tour circuit and promote it and do all those things?
We did. We were asked afterward to help go to openings. And so David went to some cities. I went to some cities. Araceli, she was from Spain, so she did the European thing. We were asked to, and we got paid to go to the promotional opening. So we would open the show, we would talk about our experiences, and then they would show the film, and then we would do Q&A. And it was a big thing because, I mean, Into Thin Air had been published. And I think a big part of why people came to this film is they wanted to see, are there more answers to my questions if I go to this movie? Why did all this happen? What happened? All those things.
Yeah, you and I are both Seattle guys.
Mm-hmm.
And,
fellow
Huskies, too.
Yes.
And I saw it down at the Seattle Center. They have an IMAX theater down there. I can't remember the name of the theater, but it was fantastic.
Yeah, the Pacific Science Center.
Yeah.
And they had just built that facility, and we did the grand openings for the facility with the film. So it was a huge, I mean, I basically lived there for 2 weeks. Every night there was an opening, every afternoon there was some sort of function. And I was coming and going and coming and going, and I kind of did all of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, do you still have a role with Eddie Bauer?
I do. Designing? I do, yes.
Tell me about that.
This is 8, 9, 10 a year. It was 2006. I was invited to come on board to work at Eddie Bauer with a group of other guides to help design a new product line they were launching called First Ascent. Mm-hmm. So it was a higher level, more technical line of clothing, packs, sleeping bags, and tents. And they were very innovative in thinking, we're going to bring on a group of people that live in this stuff, use this equipment to help the designers actually make something that's really great and usable. And so we spent 3 years developing the product line, which we called First Ascent. And then in 2009, when we had everything kind of buttoned down and ready to launch, Eddie Bauer and the people there said, we want to send you guys, the team, to Everest to launch the brand so that we can get footage, we can get imagery, we have you guys using the stuff you tested, final shakedown, and that's how I ended up going to Everest for my 11th time.
Wow, 11 times.
Yeah.
So of the 11, you've been on top, what, 7?
7. So that was my 7th ascent. And it was, I kind of thought long and hard, do I really want to go back to Everest again for the 11th time? I thought I would never go again, but I kind of justified it. I thought I get to help launch this brand of equipment that I helped develop, and I could say goodbye to Everest. I would know in my heart that that was my last climb of Everest. So I would...
I don't think so. No, it's you and I never...
Well, never say never, but at least... If it doesn't happen again, I had like a final visit and I could say goodbye to this mountain that I'd been to 11 times. So it was pretty cool. And we got to the summit and all the gear we developed worked. So there was proof in the pudding that we knew what we were doing, and we launched this brand. And so First Ascent now is a really solid part of Eddie Bauer.
Well, that must have been really cool for you being a mountain guy. I know you had an education as a veterinarian.
Yeah, right.
Veterinarian, you know, way back when, but it was kind of a whole new field for you to go into. But at the same time, you know it works and doesn't work. And so even though you don't know how to sew and, you know, you're putting feathers in a jacket, you do know what you need when you get up in those stressful conditions.
Right. And I'd had a lot of experience of that. In 1993, I was invited to work with Mountain Hardware. Yeah. They were this brand new brand. A friend of mine and his father funded the start of the company. They invited me to be their poster boy. So I grew with them and they grew with me. And I was with Mountain Hardware for 10 years.
Yeah, great company.
So I knew, and they trusted me as well. They said, Ed, what do you want? What can we make you? Even though we're only going to maybe make one for you, we're going to learn something about how to put something together easier, better, simpler, more functional. And so they take advantage of the knowledge that we have of how to make something very, very functional and useful.
Yeah, that's great. So are you guiding still?
I'm still guiding a little bit. I still do a couple of climb with Ed on Rainier every summer kind of thing, because I have enough people that are interested. They want to just sign up with me. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a celebrity type trip. Yeah. But that's kind of the guiding that I do right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the other stuff you're doing is public speaking?
Yeah, I do a lot of corporate events, yeah, motivational speaking events. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting now that the business world is looking at mountains as a really great metaphor.
Yeah.
We're all striving for something. We're all trying to reach a higher goal, yeah, right? We have to do it as a team. We have to have leadership. We have to evaluate risk. The financial industry loves the risk assessment of what we do in the mountains, when to go, when not to go. Financial investors, they've got clients that might be pressuring them to make decisions just like we do. So it translates in many different ways. And the business world loves to bring somebody from outside the box, not somebody that went to school to learn how to talk about something, but somebody that's actually lived it. And then shows amazing, beautiful pictures and tells some stories, and people kind of walk away inspired.
No, I do know. I'm speaking next week, and the whole theme is ascent, right?
So, right.
You know, speaking of First Ascent, their theme is ascent. And you're obviously this way times 1,000, but I think there's, when people get up to speak, there's two ways you do it. There's great speakers like a Tony Robbins or Bob Costas or somebody who are very fantastic storytellers, on talking about what other people have done. And when I talk and when you talk, it's about personal experience.
Right.
How that relates into real world stuff.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And I just prefer to be, I've always preferred to be that guy. I mean, I want to be out there getting my hands dirty, figuring it out. And it's just, it's rewarding for me. So not taking anything away from anybody else, but
yeah,
but I'm, you're in that same path too.
Yeah. And I never envisioned myself being a motivational speaker. Yeah. Never. When I was climbing, I thought, why would I do that? But it was after the IMAX film and after what I did in the 8,000 meter peaks, I started to get invited by CEOs and presidents that might've heard the story or seen the film or read my books and said, these are great messages. I want you to come talk to my team about what you experienced, because they can learn from you. They can see what's achievable. They can learn how to work together as a team and do something day by day and overcome obstacles. And so it just slowly, organically turned into what I do now, never thinking that this is what I would do.
Yeah. And your home is here in Sun Valley.
Yeah. Yeah. So I travel in and out from Sun Valley. I'm home 5-6 days a week, and then I'll go on the road for 2 or 3 days, and then I come home, and that's my life.
That's a great life.
It's great, yeah.
Yeah, and are you still climbing crazy mountains?
Not the crazy, not the big. I kind of decided after Annapurna, I can pull it back a few notches. But there's always that question I get now, especially after Annapurna, people go, what's next? They think you've achieved this amazing goal. You're going to try to outdo yourself, right? That's kind of what the athlete goes through.
Yeah.
When you retire, people are like, what do you mean? And it's a really hard thing to do. Not that I retired, but I kind of thought I did the big mountains. I managed the risk. I survived an 18-year journey. I don't need to outdo that.
Yeah.
I can be happy with that. I can climb smaller mountains, and I got to travel to places I didn't have time to go to. You know, I went to Antarctica I did a couple of trips to Baffin Island. I kept adventuring, but in different ways.
Yeah, I love that. That's something I had to do after my NFL days, and I started some different businesses and fell into this place where I needed to reinvent myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't do that for anybody else besides myself, and didn't talk about it for probably 4 years until really it was down in Argentina. And then I decided to broadcast my journey, and this has really taken me to doing these podcasts and public speaking and other things I do in my life. But after the seven, there's not going to be a seven dot. It's going to be dot, 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 right?
Right.
And maybe I'm skiing to the North and South Pole, or maybe I'm doing some of these other things that you're talking about, or you and I can do a Rainier trip together. So
right.
The journey continues. It's just a matter of what that color looks like.
Yeah. You know, when I came off of Annapurna, for me, it was one of the greatest days of my life, having accomplished what I did, thinking I might never be able to do this. It might not work out. And then I did. I was so proud that I kept plugging along and I succeeded. But then on the other hand, I was like, oh, it's done. This thing that has consumed me day in and day out for 18 years, it's gone. So there was a big hole. There was a big hole. And I just had to fill it differently and just decide I am content with what I did. Don't be tempted to try to outdo that, because it gets dangerous in my sport if you try to do things for other reasons other than yourself. There's the expectation of, ooh, what do my sponsors think? And the media is no longer following me. You know, all those things that you get used to, you got to just let it go. And it's hard to do.
Well, you're a smart man and you've got a wife and some kids and those are important in your life, I know. And
oh, yeah.
There's many different colors to what adventure looks like.
Right.
So where can people find you?
My website. edvesters.com.
Okay.
It's got my phone number. It's got my email. People call and I lift up the phone and they think I have a staff of people. They can't believe I pick up the phone.
Yeah.
But if you want to get a hold of me, yeah. I have several books out. The most popular is called No Shortcuts to the Top. A lot of people have read it. They love it. It crosses all genres. You don't have to be a climber to like the stories. I talk about not only what we did, but how. You know, what do we eat? How do we go to the bathroom? What does it mean to walk away 300 feet from the summit of a mountain? And I take people on a journey, and there's a lot of stories in there as well.
Yeah. No, I love it. I've read the book. Actually, I think I listened to the book through it.
Okay, right. Yeah.
So I think I've read three of your books. So, okay, well, listen, a lot of this stuff will be in the show notes where they can reach you. I appreciate it. As I said, I'll end with where I started. You are certainly a big reason why today I'm in the mountains, and I love it, and I've got great appreciation for you on that note, and I look forward to hopefully climbing with you again one of these days.
Yeah, we should. It'd be great.
Right.
Thanks.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. If you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
At Walden University, we get the W. We come here for more than just a degree. We come here to make an impact. We step up when everything is on the line, and we create opportunities. At Walden University, we learn the skills to get us to the next level. Plus, with flexible online learning, we can do it on our time. Now it's your time. Get the W. Walden University, set a course for change. Visit waldenu.edu to learn more. Certified to operate by Chevron.